Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You know, it's a dead parakeet. That's a funny thing.
I loved him. It was unconditional love. It was even
unconditional love.
He came over.
He doesn't know you from a hole in the wall.
He knows me. He knew you. Remember, he came over once. He went, Seinfeld. He loved you too.
I'm not quite sure it was Seinfeld. And you thought that was Seinfeld.
You know?
No, it's like, yeah, that's not Seinfeld.
You know why I'm laughing? At the sadness of your entire existence.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So stand-up comedy legend Richard Lewis is back on television in the ninth season of HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm, being a thorn in Larry David's side. And Richard has been making people laugh for more than 40 years. Comedy Central has recognized Richard as one of the top 50 stand-up comedians of all time. And in Richard's own words, he goes on long tours and makes people happy. They're not him. He'll be right back here in Chicago after the new year to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Zanies. And Richard Lewis joins us tonight. Richard, how are you, my friend?
Well, I take issue with almost everything you just said. I'm not a legend. It's been almost 49 years, almost 49 years of stand-up, and
wow.
I would say that Larry David's more of a thorn in my side than I'm in his side. And,
I bet.
But I am ecstatic about this season. He didn't show me a couple of episodes that are supposed to be so shocking, but he's as fearless as they come, one of the great storytellers since Norman Lear, as far as I'm concerned. And any people that are familiar or really love the series, trust me, this is the best of all nine years. So I'm ecstatic to be part of it.
It almost seems you're the voice of reason when it comes to Larry. Which
tell my wife anything close to that sentence.
Okay.
I have not won an argument since I got married 10 years ago. We've dated for 20 years, and she would say, "You have no reason to say that." It's the exact opposite. I get along better with interviewers on radio. If you were 6'5", 10, and 11, and a woman and from Denmark, you never know what could have happened. But
very good.
Stuck with a Jewish woman from Minnesota who doesn't know whether to go ice fishing or to Barney's. It's very confused.
Nice. Well, I mean, did you even realize, Richard, that at the end of the eighth season? I mean, we're talking, you know, this was back in 2011, and year after year,
right.
Is he going to bring it back? Is he not going to bring it back? Or did you always know? Because I know you've known him a long time. Did you always know? Yeah, he's going to bring this back on the air. Was that kind of a mystery?
I only asked him one thing. We were born in the same hospital ward, 3 days apart. We knew each other as teenagers, but hated each other at some sports camp, and then never saw each other until we became inseparable best friends 8 years later when we were comics, and then we realized we were the same guys 12 years before, and it was really astonishing. But I never asked him. He came over to my house in 2000, 17 years ago, which is sort of astonishing. It's sort of like, you know, the Eagles say, well, we got all the boomers, and then they're married, their children have children, so I guess we have to sing Desperado when they were singing. You know, I mean, I miss Glenn tremendously, but I'm just saying, I mean, there's so many generations, 17 years, and it's been on, and it's all over the world, and but he came over, and he wanted me to be his friend, and I had no idea what the show was. He says, what's it like? There's no script. Oh, that's a good sign, you know, and he says, I'll have an outline and we'll ad-lib, which sounded exciting, and I wasn't in a series then, and, you know, in those years, I was touring a lot. I did some TV. I did a few little indie movies, but nothing that notable, but touring went well. I was, you know, doing town hall and big venues, and did a couple of Super Bowl commercials, so it wasn't like I was begging him to come back. I was just praying that Curb would come back because I'm such a fan. I mean, I'm not a regular. I'm on in about half of them, so
that's cool.
You know, I'm like I feel I can say that I'm a fan of the show, and And but, you know, he asked me to be on it, and I did make a demand. I did say, look, you know, I'm not going to do a cameo in the first episode like, you know, back in the day. People, you're too young to know, but like an Earl and the Fall and the Family, Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, yeah.
Showed up at,
sure.
at his O'Connor's door, and he freaked out, and it was like, that's a
right.
cameo. And I said,
right.
no cameo. Oh, there's Richard Lewis getting some meds at the drugstore. Not that Larry would ever do something as stupid as that. But
at any rate.
I said, give me at least 3 or 4 episodes to see if we can develop a relationship. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then you gave me a shot. And he did that, and he's been... And the show got reviews that I've never seen before, and they singled us out too in our relationship. And no one can have our relationship. I'm not boasting, but to know somebody for your entire life and to go through what we went through, it's hard to describe. I mean, it's acting to some degree. I've studied acting. I know what acting is. I've studied method acting and I don't need much method acting to get in touch with who I am, because it's me when they say action. The whole thing is so convoluted.
Yeah, it is.
And my wife says, how did it go? I go, don't ever ask me that again. Remember we fought last night at the restaurant? We had a similar scene. And I mean, I don't know what I said. He's going to edit it. I don't know what's going to be in
sure.
there. I always tease him about that. But he always watches my back. He couldn't have a better friend. And I think he truly is and I've mentioned it once or twice, I apologize, but the Norman Lear of the last 30, 40 years,
oh, yeah.
without question, between Seinfeld and Curb. And, you know, people didn't understand how difficult it was to write a 6-page outline and hope that the actors come through and make it funny. Well, he did cast well. I mean, present company excluded, but we have a nice relationship. But,
but
the casting is insanely brilliant. And all we know, like the first episode this year, my parakeet died and he couldn't care less. And that was all I knew when I ran into him at a party. I said, what's the scene, Larry? I don't know. Your parakeet's dead. Action. You know, and
I love that, man.
And I prayed I'd be funny. You know, what can I do?
Well, you know, you mentioned, and this is crazy to me, that obviously, okay, you met in camp in like 1960 or somewhere. But when did you find out you were born in the same hospital?
That happened when we had dinner. Our dinners are pretty Curb-esque anyway. He winds up staying for a minute or two and leaves because he doesn't want to pay a parking ticket on a meter. I mean, the whole thing is insane. But forgetting that, we were talking about, he was born in Brooklyn, so was I. I said, where were you born? He said, Brooklyn Jewish Hospital. I said, so was I. It's no longer there. And since I was born 3 days before him, we were in the same ward.
That's crazy.
It's pretty, well, I knew it was a guy I wouldn't like. Ultimately, he was mocking me because I was a preemie, and he was spanking me with his mother's umbilical cord.
Nice.
There's a little SM going on there. I don't want to really talk much more about it.
I got it. But because of that friendship.
I was only an inch long at that point.
Oh, jeez.
So, you know, it didn't really hurt that much. It actually felt like a massage.
but with all this chemistry and all this friendship, I mean, when you actually, you said, you know, it's a quick outlet.
I wouldn't go as far as to say chemistry. We have a love-hate relationship. Not hate. I love him. I would drop anything. I love his two daughters. They're spectacular. And I admire him, and I'm glad that it worked out. I mean, stand-up wasn't his thing. He just couldn't handle having people talk or order a drink when he was on. Go figure that out.
Yeah, that sounds
but,
right.
But, you know, I'm glad that Seinfeld was getting hot at the time, and everybody knew Larry had a great brain, and they hooked up, what else can you say? Every channel in North Korea has Seinfeld on now.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was one of the greatest successes. It's not the greatest in history.
Yeah.
So, you know, but to follow it up with a Seinfeld unplugged, I think is astonishing. And, they're both great shows, you know, and, I've made a career out of unraveling myself on stage. And I've left a lot of Lewis dust on zany stages for almost 37 years. I think I started there about 3 years after Rick Ewart, who passed, opened the club.
Wow.
And I must have done thousands of shows there. And they treat me like family. And you know, I don't do late shows anymore because I just turned 70, and I, you know, even though I like giving them PR, I, you know, why suffer a stroke and give them more
that's
PR?
Right. That's right, exactly.
Rob, as the producer of this show, once more, I must insist that you instruct your staff to show me a little respect.
We're showing you as little respect as possible.
What can we do for you, Mel?
I came here to invite you to a party.
Hey, a party! When? When is the party? When?
Rob, the party's tonight at Allen's. He's giving a little dinner for a few of the network executives.
And you mean the star wants us to mingle with them?
Oh, yes, you may bring your wives, dates, or what have you.
Oh, goody, I'll bring my what have you.
I beg your pardon.
Well, he's not exactly a what have you. He's more of a what is it?
The Dick Van Dyke Show. Starring Dick Van Dyke. Rosemary.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So for over 90 years, Ms. Rosemarie's husky voice, good looks, and comic timing has entertained us. Rosemarie started her career at the age of 3 by starring in several of the earliest talking films, beginning with the 1929 short Baby Rosemarie, The Child Wonder. She worked with all the greats of vaudeville, theater, radio, television, and film. She had a Broadway run in Top Banana. She made numerous guest appearances in all the hottest shows of the day, headlining in Vegas, appearing at some of the biggest nightclubs, starred in several television shows, including The Dick Van Dyke Show and The Doris Day Show, and of course, Hollywood Squares. She's really never stopped working. She's a legend and honestly one of the funniest women in the history of comedy, and that is the legendary Rosemarie. Hello there, Ro.
Well, isn't that nice? What a wonderful saying. Thank you.
You're welcome. Absolutely. What a thrill to talk to you tonight. You know, your career, and I look at this, it truly has spanned over 90 years. And, you know,
it sure has.
Yeah, working since you were a kid. You were born in New York City, and your mom used to take you to the theater, and you would come home and sing the songs you just heard.
We lived in a what they used to call a railroad flat on the bottom floor in New York City. And my mother loved the theater and loved the, and 14th Street in New York at that time was the 42nd Street at this time. And all the movies, all the theaters were there. And my mother loved show business, so she used to take me to see everything. I would go home and imitate everybody. Now, upstairs, the Polish people lived. And I would say to my mother, I'm going upstairs to show the Polacks what I'm doing.
God.
I could say Polacks because my mother was Polish.
That's right. There you go. There you go. You can. You can. And
so I would go upstairs.
Yeah.
And I would do everything for them. And they would be, they were the ones that entered me in the amateur contest.
Oh, they were the ones. Okay, gotcha.
They were the ones. Yeah. My mother was afraid that I wouldn't do anything. She says she does it here. I don't know whether she was doing in front of an audience or anything like that. And the people said, she'll be fine. So they bought my dress, and they bought my brocaded shoes, which, by the way, are in the museum
Smithsonian
in Washington.
Yeah, and the Smithsonian Institute. You've got a ton of stuff there, which is amazing. What Can I Say, Dear, After I Say I'm Sorry was the song you auditioned with. And you were about 3 years old, right? I mean, 3.
That's right.
Wow. I mean, just to have a memory to sing a song accompanied.
Well, first of all, I never sounded like a child.
Yeah, right.
Everybody used to say, that's a 90-year-old midget, you know. And no child sings like that because I sounded like Sophie Tucker. It was a heavy, harsh voice. And I've always had this heavy voice, and from the time I was 3 years old. And so everybody thought I was a midget until I was signed to NBC, and NBC sent me on a tour of theaters because they were affiliated with RKO.
Right.
And I would do vaudeville 52 weeks a year in each of the RKO theaters across the country. And I played in Chicago many, many times.
Yes, you did. You did, including the Palmer House. But you were performing, and I love that NBC did that because what it did is it introduced you to audiences live so they could see you.
That's right. And I had my program Sunday mornings at 10:15. Every Sunday morning for 15 minutes, me, a piano player, and an announcer. And that was a show And everybody used to write in, as I told you, said, that's not a child, that's a midget. So they would send this, me across the country to prove that I was a child.
Yeah.
And so many things happened along the way. I worked with some of the greatest vaudeville people. I learned how to do everything they did because they felt sorry for the kid, you know? And they would teach me how to juggle, how to do this, how to throw adagio dances and turns. They taught me everything. The vaudeville people I worked with were just wonderful. And they went into, a lot of people went into movies and television.
Yeah, and you were performing, and this is kind of wild because I didn't know this, and I read this in your book. You know, you performed in nightclubs that were kind of family-friendly. You think nightclubs, you think about adults, but there were some family-friendly venues that you could go perform at.
Oh, yeah. Nightclubs weren't what nightclubs later became. Nightclubs in those days, it was a family place where you could bring your family. There'd be a singer, a dancer, a dance team, a nice orchestra that you could dance with, and music, and you could bring kids. It was like a country club.
Yeah, yeah.
Nightclubs were very, very family orientated. Not like later as they got into the sophisticated type of entertainment.
And I found about really your background, you know, probably about 20 years ago, but probably as a kid, I thought to myself, well, she got started on the Dick Van Dyke Show. You did not. Obviously, it was 35 years before that. You had this whole other life of singing and comedy and nightclubs before that. And I was looking at some of the names you worked with. And first of all,
you said you read my book.
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Oh, I loved it. Oh, God, it was a great story because I learned so much about you. I mean, I really didn't know about this whole other career that you had, you know?
Oh, I've had many careers.
You have. You have. You totally have. But, you know, you said you made records, RKO theater appearances, your own radio show where they called you the darling of the airwaves.
Yeah.
Paramount films and shorts. You were big long before the days of a Shirley Temple. And I know you knew Shirley.
Well, I was big in my area. She was big in her area. She was in the movies. I was doing all live stuff.
Yeah, amazing. And in all this live stuff, in vaudeville.
I had my own program,
yeah.
Coast to Coast, when I was 5 years old.
That's crazy. I know, it's wild. For 7 years. I mean, you had a seven-year contract with these folks. But you worked with some of the greats even when you were a kid. I was looking at this. Edgar Bergen, Dick Powell, Milton Berle, when you were a child.
You know, I want to tell you something.
Yeah.
I remember everybody, and there isn't anybody that I haven't worked with or been with or did a movie with. It's amazing. And Dave, they're all gone.
Yeah, they are all gone.
They're all gone. Yeah. I'm the only one that remembers them.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, you know what? I'm in my late 40s, and I'm kind of one of those guys that likes to keep these legends alive. Because, you know, I talked to Don Rickles earlier last year.
Oh, that's nice.
And I know
he
you worked with
dear,
him.
Dear friend.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know that. I know that. Back in the day, were your parents very involved in managing your career?
Or my father.
Your father. Okay.
My father, as in the book, my father. My mother stayed home and took care of my brother.
And you were about, I think it was about when you were 16, you were finally a teenager, you worked, I was looking at the list of nightclubs you worked at, the Versailles nightclub in New York. This was a hot nightclub.
That's how I started, because New York had a child labor law because of all the young kids that worked in Europe, the 10 cents a dollar or something. It was the child labor law in New York that you couldn't sing or dance in New York. And the only way you could get away with it is if you were an actress and could do a part, but you couldn't sing or dance. So when I was 16, the first thing I did was the Versailles Club in New York, where I sang and did an act.
Wow. And I'm looking at you performed there, Bob Hope, Dean Martin, Desi Arnaz, Jerry Lewis. I mean, this was one of the big clubs in the country.
Yeah, yeah.
The Copacabana in New York, the Palmer House in Chicago.
Oh, I worked at Copa. I worked at Shea Paris many times.
Yeah.
Many, many times. The Chicago Theater, the Capitol Theater in New York, 3 or 4 times a year. And I opened up Las Vegas. You read the story.
Yeah, the Flamingo. And I've heard you tell it, too. The Flamingo Hotel you opened up.
Yeah, right.
Which was owned by
Bugsy
Siegel, Big Mobster. And I know over your career, you crossed paths with the likes of Bugsy, Al Capone, you know, these mafia figures that
They were my buddies.
Yeah, they helped you, right?
I had to be... first of all, I was at the Palace Theater in Chicago working with Milton Berle. And somebody came backstage. The doorman came backstage and said, we want to see you, Rosemary. And so he told my father, and my father came out with me, and there was Al Capone in a limousine.
Wow.
And waiting by the door then. And he said to my father, hello, Happy. I didn't know my father's name was Happy. They called him Happy Hank.
Wow.
And he was involved with the mob.
When somebody breaks your heart.
You mentioned to me, Ro, that you worked and knew Danny Thomas and Sheldon Leonard, and there was one day after you did a short-lived sitcom that you got a call to report to Desilu, and that was for the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Well, what happened was when I worked in Vegas, Danny Thomas and Sheldon were very close friends, and they always came to see me in Vegas. And Sheldon used to say to me, don't you ever bomb? And I said, not that I can help it, you know. And Danny Thomas had a show called Make Room for Daddy.
Right, right, right.
And I said, we're friends, we're family. Why the hell don't I do your show? I want a guest shot.
Yeah.
And he would say,
reasonable.
Your time will come. Mm-hmm. Your time will come. And I'd say, fine. You know, that was it. So one day I got a call, and they said, go down to Desilu. Danny Thomas, I said, I finally got it. And I went down. That's when I met Carl Reiner.
Wow.
And Sheldon said in front of me, which made me very proud, if you want the best, get Rosemary.
Wow. Yeah.
And Carl said, I didn't read for the part. I didn't have to do anything. Mm-mm. I walked in and it was my part. And I met everybody and I said, who have you got to the third writer?
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm jumping a very important thing.
Yeah.
When they told me to come down to Desilu, I said, oh, I finally got the guest shot on the show. And the woman said, no, this is for a new show called The Dick Van Dyke Show. I said, what's a Dick Van Dyke? Just go down there.
Yeah.
So I went down there, yeah. And I met Carl and Sheldon and... I read the part. I didn't have to read for it. The part was mine. I looked at the script and I said, who have you got to the third writer? They said, well, we haven't picked him yet. And I said, what about Maury Amsterdam? He knows every joke, known as the joke machine.
Yeah, of course.
He's absolutely fantastic. He'd be perfect for this. Do you know where we could reach him? I said, I have his home phone number. So I gave him the phone number. I came home. I called him up and I said, they're going to call you for a new show called The Dick Van Dyke Show. He says to me, what's The Dick Van Dyke?
Of course he did.
I said, I don't know, but get your ass out of here.
Ah, that's fantastic.
He says, I'll see you Monday. He never read to the part. They just took him.
I bet. Oh, I bet. That's amazing to hear that because the chemistry on this show was so incredibly natural, it blew me away.
I'm so glad you noticed that.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was very true.
I mean,
everybody knew what everybody was going to do. Everybody looked out for one another. Everybody makes jokes about, oh, we're like a family. That show, honest to God, was like a family.
That's amazing. It's amazing. And it was at a time, Robert, where sponsors had to buy the show to get it on the air. And I know Procter & Gamble and Kent Cigarettes, I think, were the sponsors for the show.
Yeah.
But after the first season, a lot of people don't know this, it kind of was canceled until summer reruns came around.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and as
we were sold when we made the pilot.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't have to show anything. And I know Carl wrote, like, 10 episodes in a row. Like, he was moving.
Well, Carl wrote, it was Carl's show. Carl wrote 13 episodes, and he made a pilot of himself as
right.
Dick Van Dyke.
Head of the family, yeah.
And it was terrible.
Yeah, it wasn't that good.
And he came out to California with Sid Caesar, I guess. I don't know. But saw Sheldon, and Sheldon said, "This is a great show." He says, "But you're not going to be in it." He says, "You be the producer." And Carl says, "But I want to play it." He says, "This is for somebody else. But you produce the shows. You write the shows." And Sheldon went back to New York and found Dick Van Dyke in Bye Bye Birdie.
Wow.
And said, "He's the one to play it."
Yeah. Yeah.
And Dick wasn't known at all.
No, he really wasn't. No.
Nobody knew who the hell he was.
They didn't know Mary Tyler Moore either. I mean, she was a hot point commercial girl.
She was the last thing that ever was cast anyway.
Yeah.
We were all set, and Danny was looking for the girl with three names.
To match Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know you've stayed really close friends to Dick Van Dyke over the years.
Oh,
as well.
Yes,
yeah.
Very.
Yeah.
Dick gives me a lot of credit for a lot of things I don't deserve.
Oh, that's sweet. That's sweet. And I'm so hard to hear of Mary's passing at such a young age as well. But Richard Deacon for you, he was like an older brother to you, wasn't he?
Oh God, he was wonderful. He really was my older brother. He really was. I mean, so much so that when my husband died, he used to come over and say, "I'm going to take you out to dinner, get dressed. You're going out of the house." And he was the one that got me out of my doldrums. I was in bad shape, Dave, when my husband died.
Yeah.
We were married 20 years very, very happily. And I mean, you could say love of my life, really.
Yeah.
I never married again. I couldn't be bothered because nobody could fill that shoe.
And so they were a family to you, I mean, right?
Dick took me out like his date. I mean, he took me to Rock Hudson's house, to this one's house, and Rock Hudson was wonderful. And I used to say to Rock, I said, "I hate that name. I'm going to call you Sam." He said, "I want you to do me a favor." And I said, "What?" He said, "I'm having a party. Will you be the hostess?" And that's what they all did. They all helped me.
Wow.
They were just wonderful.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's what family's all about. And as you said, this was a family.
They were all such good friends. Every one of them was so kind to me. It was, I can't tell you anybody that was mean to me or nasty to me or any. I can't tell you. I wish I could.
Yeah.
I'd give you a good story.
That's awesome. Yeah, no,
but
that's awesome.
I can't. Everybody respected me and loved me. And the last thing I did, episodically, I did something just a little while ago. I did the voiceover in Garfield, you know, the cat.
Yep. Yes, I do. Yep.
I played a witch in the cat in that cartoon that's going to come out soon.
Oh, that's great. That is fantastic. That is fun.
And Richard used to take me to all these things to keep me going and take me out to dinner. He'd say, "Get dressed. I'm taking you out to dinner." I said, "I don't want to go. Leave me alone."
Yeah.
He says, "Get dressed because whatever you're wearing is what you're going to be seen in."
That's great.
So we were very close. I mean, it sounds like a cliche or trying to make an impression. I'm just telling you the truth.
Yeah. It's nice to hear. It's nice to hear because it's kind of what viewers have in their mind when they watch the show and see the camaraderie. It's nice to hear that behind the scenes, that was very prevalent as well.
And do you know that if anything, if you didn't like the way he said a line or you thought maybe it might be better this way, you could go over to him and say, "I think maybe if you try it this way, it might be better." Nobody got mad.
Yeah.
Nobody got insulted.
Everyone just wanted to make it better.
Everybody said, "I'll try it. I'll try it.
Yeah.
You know, like that. It was wonderful. It was, and the director, John Rich, oh God, what a wonderful man. And of course, Jerry Paris.
Yeah.
When John died, Jerry Paris took over.
Yeah.
And he was just great.
Yeah.
I mean, we were very lucky. We had wonderful, wonderful people.
I
even went into the editing room. John wanted me to be a director. He said, "You'd be great as a director." He says, "Because you know what to do."
Yeah.
He says, "I want you to see how this is done." And took me into the editing room.
You know, and that's great because, you know, when you've been in the business as long as you have, it's great to know more than one thing, right?
Oh, I got to tell you, this is one of my favorite stories. This is my conceited story.
Okay.
I did a show called, I forgot the name of it. It was the last show of the season.
Okay.
And I was called in. And the director and everybody was wonderful, and we were working. And while we were working, the director called me over and said, I wish the show was the last show of the season, because you would be on every show. Nobody has worked as good as they do with you. It's a pleasure.
How nice is that?
Thank you. Now, the topper, we're doing the show, and in the middle of the show, I go, sir, I said, should I move on this line, or should I sit down on this line? And he looked at me and said, you're asking me?
That's awesome. You earned that respect.
I said, you're the director. He said, you do what you want to do, honey. You're doing all right.
That's
and
great.
That was in front of an audience.
Yeah.
It made me very proud.
Yeah, of course. Of course. You earned that respect, you know? Absolutely.
And then Four Girls Four. Did you ever hear about that?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yeah. Tell us about that.
That was spectacular, Dave. That was the best show that ever happened.
Hey, Tommy, tell me one thing. What do you want to do? I want to ask you a question.
Yes, go
ahead. What do you want to do when you finally grow up?
Smack you right in the mouth.
All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So it was nearly six decades ago that Dickie and Tom Smothers first took stage together professionally, and 50 years since the debut of the groundbreaking Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Many comedy duos have had success, but none as enduring as the Smothers Brothers, whose lengthy career has surpassed all other comedy teams in history. Their cutting-edge humor has not only been ahead of its time, but it has remained timeless as well. The legendary Dickie Smothers will be appearing at IO Chicago's Music Improv Festival right here in Chicago on August 18th and 19th, and he's joining us this morning. Good morning, Dickie.
Hey, it's great to be on your show. Pleasure.
I am thrilled that you're joining us. You are a legend in comedy, and I was mentioning to you before the call, my sister and I had this album we discovered, I think when we were like 7, 8 years old, called The Golden Hits of the Smothers Brothers, Volume 2, and we must have played that album 50 times, and still today, and I listened to it yesterday, still today, every single bit of it stands up.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Did you, a question, did you ever search for volume one?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. So I was like, no, I did. And then I just realized, okay, there's the joke. There is no volume one. That's fantastic.
Yeah, when we released the Time Life videos of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, We started with the third season, and I said, and they said, well, why do you want the third? I said, because they'll be so bored by the first end of the first season, they won't want to see what happens next.
That's brilliant. No, that's brilliant.
So, well, I don't know how brilliant it is, but we were short on material, but long on timing and being in the right point in history with the right mentality. And my brother was, Tommy was born in a delightful, damaged fashion, like we all are. That's what makes us unique. You know, we have these little defects and assets, and they don't go across the board. If you're smart in math, like Einstein, I understand. One time he left the house to get on the train to go to work, and he forgot his pants. So, you know, but he was not a dumb guy that kept forgetting pants. It's just that, well, Tommy has dyslexia, is part of it. He's really deep, smart guy. And our sensitivities when the 60s happened, and really important, the Kingston Trio had popularized folk music, and it really hit like nothing else in the colleges, young people. And that was in time for, and that was in the late 50s. Then the 60s came in, and all the civil discourse and the drugs, pot, civil rights, all that stuff was in place. And we were in place.
You absolutely were,
I think the people that were really effective in the young people in the 60s were a product of the 50s, and most of the were either boomers, we're calling them boomers now, or we predated the boomers by about 10 years. So I know when we can relate to the boomers because we're only say 10 years apart plus, and I related to the Jack Bennies and the Burns and the Skeltons and all this stuff because they were in place and really cooking. Like when you discovered us, we had established ourselves, but getting there was the most long shot of anything, how we got there. But you didn't care. All you knew is there were certain things that were out there, and you were young.
Yeah.
And this People don't realize, like the Beatles, what were they influenced by? The American Songbook.
That's right.
Like anybody else, classical American Songbook, all that stuff. And then they took that as a foundation with their creativity and the right amount of drugs and input and social things and a combination of brains and talent, you know, that mixture, and did something that nobody ever did before with the same stuff that we all saw and didn't see anything different.
Well, speaking of the Great American Songbook, I mean, that's kind of where you got a lot of that stuff from in the very early days when you and Tommy started performing together. It was about the music, but when did comedy come into that?
Well, the first time we had not enough songs to fill up a show. we needed more time.
Yeah.
That's pretty common. You know, what are we going to do with all this extra time? Maybe that's the first musical. They said, what are you going to do with this this show you have? You wrote a show, it's too short. Oh, we'll sing a few songs. Let's fill up the time. We'll call it a musical. and Tommy and I were so blessed that Tommy, I keep saying blessed. Everybody was blessed. The same era we lived there. But there were story songs around, like Tom Dooley, John Henry, all that stuff. That and folk music came out with that really hit songs in the early 50s with the Weavers, Pete Seeger, Beautiful Brown Eyes, Goodnight Irene. They were top hits. They didn't relate to any group, social group, ethnic group or anything. They were just there. And then when the youth came in and they really for the first time had something to say and nowhere to say it, we happened to have a TV show that related to them, and we filled it with young writers and people that could connect with the counterculture and all the stuff that was happening, you know, pot, war, the draft, civil rights, you name it. And by accident, we were the right people to fill a time slot on Sunday night at 9 o'clock opposite Bonanza, which was a dark hole. I don't know if a lot of your audience realize or think about it, that if you were watching a show at 9 o'clock, there was two other shows you could not tape. Or could not record. Yeah. You missed them.
No, Bonanza was number one, and it was unbeatable, really, at that time.
It was terribly unbeatable.
Yeah.
And by accident, it just because William Morris, our agency, talked to CBS and to say, you got to have some younger hosts. You know, you're aging. Your team is, the players on your field are aging, like a football team. Let's get some young people. And it happened to be that time, and we were in place in our career, that they picked us, and it was like a suicide mission. But Tommy says, well, what the hell? We can't lose. Everybody is not successful here, so we could only be like everybody else. But we could maybe do something, and we'll have our own show. How many times are you offered your own show?
But now you have complete creative control handed over to you.
Reluctantly, they said that, and then they took it back.
Well,
they thought we were going to fail, of course. But think of the great people that predated us. Jack Benny and George Burns, two of my favorite. What was the premise of their shows? They were both married, and they were at home.
And that was
they
it.
Were themselves.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's what they did.
Yeah.
You know? And so what happened was it had that time slot was really dire for CBS to fill it up. They were the spot when we went against Bonanza in that season, the 66 season, they were rated at the most watched hour of the week.
Right.
It was Sunday night at 9 o'clock. More TV sets turned on, which was important. And they rated 90th or something. They were the last, you know how much money they were losing for advertising. Okay. So they were really, desperate. And so why not? A variety show is quick to put together. It's less expensive than film, and we could do it right now. And so they said, okay, this is Mother's Brothers. And we were very safe then. That all that civil rights stuff and the counterculture was foaming. It was fermenting.
Yeah, it was developing.
In the early 60s,
right.
And we had short hair, big ears, Middle West stuff. Their daddy was a war hero. They sing folk songs. What can go wrong? Or what could go right? They'll probably be in and out, and we'll work on something with substance. And Michael Dan, one of the executives at CBS in charge of variety shows and specials and stuff, took a big leap and really was our champion. And he changed the direction. Not only did we change what television could put on a family viewing hour, not unbeknownst to us, variety show was being phased out, except for Ed Sullivan, mm-hmm. which really wasn't variety. It was a vaudeville show, a really great one. And they were canceling all the Red Skelton. They were canceling Dan Kay and all the older people.
Sure.
And it turned around. It was so hot. And by the way, our show was not unique. It was just a regular variety show. It was the elements and the execution and who we booked on the show.
Absolutely.
That made it unique.
Topical, yeah. Edgy, so, not only unique, but relevant. I think that's...
Yeah, we were really relevant. Now, Carol Burnett was 2 weeks away from being hired for that show.
Wow.
And they wouldn't have lost her. They had an option on her. That the option was running out 2 weeks after they booked us on the show. Now, say they chose Carol Burnett, it never would have been the same. Right. I think they would have been very successful. That was the most brilliant three-wall show ever. Ever.
Yeah,
the cast, it cut ours 18 ways, but it wouldn't have done, it wouldn't have driven any political boundaries.
No.
It wouldn't have opened doors. So that's why we were maybe Isaac Newton. We discovered one thing. He discovered gravity, and we've been talking about it ever since.
Well,
a long time ago.
You talk about
talk about us.
No, they do, and you talk about the edginess of the writers and the people you brought on the show. So I'm looking at the writers and regular performers: Steve Martin, Don Novello, Rob Reiner, Pat Paulson, of course, Albert Brooks, and then you went outside that typical variety show box and introduced audiences to musical acts that other variety shows would never touch. George Harrison, Buffalo Springfield, Cass Elliott, The Doors, Glenn Campbell, of course, Peter Paul Mary, Ringo, Simon and Garfunkel, The Who. I mean, that was a damn cool show, I got to tell you.
And we also had the Juilliard String Quartet. And we had, remember Jackie Leonard?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, he was like a Don Rickles genre, but not... There's different genres in the same insult type of things. He was a good Jewish comic, a little cocker, big heavy guy. Guess what we had him do on our show? He sang a melancholy song, Fool on the Hill. And CBS says, you're crazy. He's a comic. Make him do his comedy stuff. No, it was a melancholy, introspective song that nobody expected.
Yeah.
And you know what? I was watching that CNN thing the other day, History of Comedy.
Comedy,
God,
right.
It is great. All those films. I never knew that Airplane, which is the best spoof or whatever you would
movie,
call it,
yeah.
of all time, was shot frame for frame and almost dialogue for dialogue is some airplane drama that was serious.
Right, right,
and
right.
When they said certain lines within that serious format delivered serious, it was hilarious and so unexpected. And I think we kept doing a few unexpected things on a normal framework of a show. Singers, dancers, a major A star, maybe two, and that's how you promoted your movie and your records and all that stuff. And CBS would say, you have Eddie Albert and Gabor, not Jaja, the other one, Ava Gabor, and promote Green Acres. You had to service certain things. But whenever we didn't, we weren't forced to do that. We did like to go out and do the unexpected.
Well, the other thing, too, is you introduced music videos. That was the other thing. We didn't even call them music videos at the time. But in the 60s, the Beatles weren't really doing live television anymore. So you would you debuted Hey Jude and Revolution as a video. And
that's
it was pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, it was those things just squirt out. They squirt out when things are going right.
Yeah.
And we didn't try to break new ground. We just did what's the right thing to do. Tommy said, Tommy was the driven force. Tommy was the driver. I would have been a retired teacher or a mediocre attorney or a doctor or whatever. My life has changed so drastically because of Tom. And it forces out of our control, put us in a family unit that was dysfunctional. And we were bonded more together and decided, that this might be a good thing to try out together. We didn't resent each other. And the funny thing is, Mom always liked you best was never an issue. we took care of Mom.
Classic.
Mom had a lot of issues. and but we loved her
yeah.
to death. And
yeah.
and what Tommy discovered improvisationally one day, just screamed out, "Well, Mom liked you best because I'd been beaten up on him for about 5 minutes on stage. How unworthy he was, not only to be a brother, to be alive, to be breathing air and eating food,
right,
you
right.
know, and I was ripping his buttons off his coat because he doesn't even deserve his coat to be buttoned. Nothing. You don't even deserve clothes." And then, and after I ran out of gas, totally, this is the Crystal Palace in St. Louis, a really hot club back then. And he just looked at me, and the audience was quiet as hell. And he says, "Oh yeah, well, Mom always liked you best." Which was, and it was the biggest laugh I've ever.
Oh yeah, still
and
is,
because it was the last and the biggest nail in his coffin of non-importance.
Yeah, he's had enough.
He did it himself.
Yeah, exactly.
And funny thing is, Mom liked him better, and so all these years, he's reminding me of it, and the audience gives him sympathy for it. So that's what siblings do to each other.
Of course, of course.
You have a double-edged, double entendre there type of thing.
Of course. But, now, every week on TV, you know, you're doing the show. And, Dick, I know you know, you taped the show twice, which was the way they were done back then. So you could tweak things, I guess, for the second show and use the best
yeah.
of both shows. But, you know, in the nightclubs, comedy clubs, you had time to refine the act and the jokes and see what worked and what didn't, and then just massage it and change it for the next time. But this was very tight. I mean, tight. You had time only between the first show and the second show to see what
about
was flying.
Hour.
Was that
yeah.
was that more challenging, yeah. I would assume?
Yeah, well, television, live television, even live, it's live television if they tape and they edit and they delay it a little bit. It's considered live.
Yeah.
Yeah, television is get it done. No matter how good it is, we're going to put it on. And so that's the challenge, and that's the excitement. That's the excitement of improv shows. When people go to an improv show,
yeah.
it could be really flat that night. Oh, my God. There's these personalities have to interact, and they're not even writing it. So
right.
just think how scary that is as a performer. And Monday, our show was first time a cast would see it and people would show it would be Monday at a read-through. And of course, the writers are there. All the staff is there. The writers laugh like hell at their piece.
Yeah,
they're laughing like, "Oh, that's so great! Oh, it's wonderful!" And the pages are all white. There's white pages, you know.
Yeah.
And every time there's a change, it's a different color, and they stick in a few pages here, or there, and there. So the show by Friday is a rainbow.
Right, right.
Of color.
Right, right.
And you might have five elements that has to be rehearsed. That we're in, plus our connecting the shows, Tommy and I do our little read-throughs and Tom and Dick spots, but then we have to service the acts that we really want, and we have no time to refine them. You do a couple days, say like 2 or 3 hours of rehearsal over a few days, and then it's camera blocking. And that's for the cameras, not for you. So you don't get any sense of timing or what's funny. You have to use your instincts. And of course, you're not waiting for a dress, but you're hoping that you're refining it without really a true run through. And then comes the run through prior to getting on the run. That time is a run through prior to getting on stage to the block. And you have CBS, you have the sensors, you have all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And things aren't as many times funny as you thought.
Right.
And then you get on camera, and then we do the dress, by the way. It's like doing a real show. The concert, they show up. And we had our requirements for the set designer and the writing was that a maximum of an hour and a half shooting time for an hour show.
Okay.
And that means you have a couple of set changes. They better be quick. We want the audience.
It was almost live. It was almost live.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And we sent out a guy that wasn't a bad comic to talk to the people, keep him going. And sometimes the dress had some great elements. Sometimes it was bad. Sometimes we've used the entire dress rehearsal with flaws because it had that life we wanted. We never sweetened the show. There weren't any laugh track. And if you didn't earn your laugh, you didn't get it. And so the spontaneity of the show, it rose. I keep thinking of Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, mm-hmm. Andy Hardy. There was a problem that was always solved by putting on a show. And the show was always a mess until the direst thing was problem solved. And they went on and it was a big hit and they solved the problem. Sometimes that's the way our show was. And you couldn't predict when it would rise. Sometimes you didn't do anything different from the dress to the air, and the air had that energy and turned the corner, and it was wonderful. And we never knew that until it was over.
It's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. For more than 40 years, Paul Schaefer has been providing the soundtrack for late-night television. He just released a new album called Paul Schaefer and the World's Most Dangerous Band, and he's joining us tonight. Good evening, Paul.
Well, am I ever happy to be with you. Good evening to you, sir.
Great to talk to you. And how's life after late night, for God's sake?
Well, you know what? It was a little slower for a while, and then I got a call from an old friend, Seymour Stein, legendary music exec, and he said, how would you like to make a record? And things picked up, you know.
Sure.
Now I'm busier than ever. I'm promoting the record. It got done. I'm very proud of it. I got the late show band from all those years in the trenches with Dave.
I love that.
I have reunited the band, and we made the record together, had a great time. Taking it on the road now. Coming to see you soon.
Yeah, yeah.
Bringing the great Valerie Simpson with me, a soul legend who wrote with her late husband, Ain't No Mountain High Enough, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing. I don't need no doctor. I could go on and on and on. You're all I need to get by. You know, giving us a lesson in soul music every single night of this tour. So I can't wait to come to this theater, which I've been looking at on YouTube.
The Arcata.
Yes, and I see it's a sort of a, I've been seeing a lot of a show that features the bands from the 60s in Chicago that I grew up listening to on WLS.
Of course.
I used to be able to hear WLS AM radio up in Canada after dark.
Sure.
And I heard all these bands like the Shadows of Night. The Crying Shames, and the group that sang Things I'd Like to Say. I can't remember what. Oh, yes, the New Colony 6.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Anyway,
yeah.
And I saw that they did this big show with all of them at this theater, the Arcata.
Yeah, Arcata Theater. Yeah.
So I can see it's almost hallowed ground when it comes to the Chicago sound.
It's a perfect match. Absolutely a perfect match. Well, you know, and I was going to tell you, I got to tell you, when I was 10 years old, I think it was maybe 1977, 78, when my parents finally let me watch Saturday Night Live. And I remember seeing you on stage and playing with Bill Murray and all that other good stuff. And
yeah.
I thought to myself, that cat is cool. Man.
How about that? I mean, you were already speaking my language, my antiquated, anachronistic language, when you were just a little kid.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you didn't see much of me on Saturday Night Live either.
It was just
a glimpse of me in the background and Bill Murray's thing and stuff. But, so that's so sweet of you to say, even when you were a kid, you had good taste in, television musicians.
That's right. Well, you know, I was looking at this because I know music has always been such a big part of your life and taking lessons when you were a kid and stuff. But you got your big break. And I look at this. Your first big deal was a Canadian production of Godspell back in 72 with the likes of Gilda Radner, Martin Short, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Dave Thomas, right out of college. I mean, that must have been surreal.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, it was like I had graduated college a year before and said to my parents, let me take, a year to try show business and music and see if it works out. Otherwise, I'll go to grad school. So I didn't know, really. But, the year was coming to an end, and just on a fluke, I got hired to be the conductor of this Godspell show. And it was an open call, They just hired all the most talented people in town. And the funniest people. We were all about 22 years old.
Wow.
I, Martin Short, Eugene, the three of us are still best friends.
That's awesome.
Andrea as well, maybe the funniest of all of them. We lost poor Gilda, of course, so long ago.
Yeah.
But, we're all still best friends and still make each other laugh on a consistent basis. And I don't know how I got so lucky. Just one of those things.
Yeah. And then you did this other show. And then after that, you were on Saturday Night Live when it actually premiered. How did that all come about? Like, how did that connection happen for you, Paul?
After that Godspell show in Toronto, I became a Mr. Theater. I was doing shows, conducting right. shows.
Yeah.
And a guy came in to play saxophone in one of the shows. It was Howard Shore. He's now a big, successful film writer, mm-hmm. music writer, you know, scoring. But at that time, he was playing shows, too. And then he turned out he was Lorne Michaels' friend who came down with him to put together the band for Saturday Night Live. Howard became a musical director. He already knew I was in town. I was still working for with Stephen Schwartz, the Godspell composer. He had brought me into town to play Broadway already, you know, by that time in New York. And Howard came into Saturday Night Live, called me up, you're already here, come down and play. And P.S., you know Gilda already, and, you know, yeah. Aykroyd and Belushi, and, you know, I knew the whole crowd. So it's very natural for me to start writing for them and developing material for them. And then I even became what they called a feature player in the fifth season and got on camera a little bit doing sketches.
You did. And, I mean, obviously, you know, that show was so relevant back then and is even more relevant today, you know, with the political culture happening in our country. It was groundbreaking. It broke all the rules. What were those early days like? I mean, you know, I know it's like constant work. I mean, you're there, you know, 6-7 days a week getting the show done.
Well, nobody had a girlfriend or anything to, you know, keep them from going and working all night there. None of us had anything to do, and it was the most exciting thing happening. Of course, it was a lot of fun to actually be able to get things on live television. You know, I worked on numbers, musical numbers that would get performed on the air. No, tremendous, tremendously exciting. Working so hard, though, that you don't realize that the show was getting well-known, it was getting successful, you know. All of a sudden, everybody became a star.
Right.
It was quite something, you know, for the first time. Didn't know how it was going to work. I couldn't even figure out how we were supposed to go on live.
Yeah.
What a daunting thought, you know?
It is, but that's how
you know you're doing it.
Yeah, you know, as I say, television, that's what it was in the 40s and 50s. I mean, so much of it was live, and that was really the norm. And then really for almost two decades, you know, everything was pre-taped and edited down. But now you had this fast-moving show. I mean, you know, unlike anything that's ever been on television before. And, yeah, going live that late at night, it sounds daunting.
Fun to do.
Yeah.
I must say, though, that live, though it was scripted, and it is scripted, and, you know, they stick to that script because they shoot it beautifully. All their shots are planned. They don't want to miss anything. Letterman wasn't really live. It was taped earlier that day, around dinner time.
Yeah.
But that was so loose and spontaneous that it was almost like it was live.
Yeah,
really, even more like flying by the seat of your pants, because there's no, you know, you're not reading a script. You are just improvising a lot of the time. It was really very, very exciting to do Letterman too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I think I probably first saw you doing the Lounge Singer skit with your buddy Bill Murray, and you reprised that role on the 40th anniversary. I know you know the origins of this Nick the Lounge Singer, because you've known Bill for so long.
You know, I think he kind of developed it. Origin, heard about Bill from his older brother, Brian, who had come to Toronto right after the Godspell of 73
okay.
to put together a Second City stage show like they were doing in Chicago.
Sure.
Brian and I hit it off. We became friends. He said, "You got to meet my brother, Bill. He's doing the show in Chicago. He does a thing where he does, with another guy, the comedy team of Alan and Rossi, who I used to see on the Sullivan Show all the time.
Mm-hmm.
One crazy monkey kind of a comic guy with wild hair, and the other guy, a very suave lounge singer kind of guy who would sing a song first, and then the other guy would come out crazy, you know, "Hey, wait a second, what are you doing here? I just finished my song." And when I got to New York, I met Billy, and we started doing things together right away. I was not on SNL. I had taken a year off to do a thing in a sitcom in Hollywood for a minute. That's a whole other story.
Greg Evigan and Mickey Rooney.
Oh, my goodness. No, why must you remember what I try so hard? Anyway,
yeah.
I came back, you know, when I came back from that show, Billy was on SNL.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. And the first thing I saw him do while I was away was shower mic, shower microphone. You remember those things?
Yep, yep,
soap,
yep.
Shower soap made in the shape of a microphone. So, and there was Billy as a character who's like doing a show in the shower with the shower mic. But then he goes a little too far. He brings his wife into the shower, you know, and then the guy with whom she's having an affair, come on, get in here, you know. And yeah. I think that may have been the origin of it. And then he developed into it, you know, hey, there's, how about he's a real lounge singer?
Yeah.
And he has Paul on piano, and he, and you know, he's at a ski lounge and stuff. And
sure.
The way Billy's mind works is, I don't know, it's sheer genius.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm noticing a lot of Chicago connections, you know, that you're mentioning through Second City and everything. And the same with the Blues Brothers, you know, very synonymous. And you did a lot of work with Dan and John. And you were supposed to be in the Blues Brothers movie, weren't you?
Well, of course. I had put the band together, musician by musician, with John.
Yeah.
But I had a little conflict of schedule and was working with Billy Radner, making a record with her. And didn't get a record done in time, and I had to pull out on John. And, oh, my God, it was such a horrible situation for me. You know, and John and I had a big feud and falling out, and we weren't speaking. And then we had a big reconciliation, though, and a happy ending, and we kissed and made up. And I rejoined the Blues Brothers for the big tour.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Where I wish we rehearsed in Chicago at the Navy Yards.
Yeah, wow.
And played Pine Knob. That was our first job, I think.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right outside of Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, a lot of connections,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
mainly that list, that Chicago radio.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, that was big for me as a kid.
Big music.
AM scene. Radio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then 82.
Big radio town.
Absolutely, still
and
is.
I guess, you know, a lot of people driving. Drive time must have been huge.
Yeah, still is. Honestly, it still is. Uh-huh. Even with all the choices today, still is in Chicago. 82 came. You were offered the role to lead the band on Late Night with David Letterman. Did you know Dave before that time, or was that kind of a first meeting?
I didn't, and I, you know, but I was familiar with him. And not only that, but he had a show in the morning.
The daytime show, right.
First, yeah, live in the morning on NBC. And I became familiar with that show, which was the funniest thing I'd ever seen, especially after they got canceled and they had to stay on the air doing shows for another month.
Right.
Well, they didn't care. Yeah. At that point, they didn't care. And
right.
It got so off the wall that I said, who is this guy? And then I got that call. You know, that show didn't pan out, a little too hip for the morning, but it contained, they were at faith in Dave, and they finally gave him a late night show. Even later than Johnny Carson, you know,
yeah.
Boy, that's late. I said, that's for me. And sure enough, you know, I went in and met Dave cold, and we hit it off. And he hired me, and that, you know, that was the first time I met him.
You know, and think about these two groundbreaking shows, because you said, you know, it was groundbreaking for that morning show to be on. It was groundbreaking, all those things that Dave did, and then Saturday Night Live, and you were part of both of these really historic groundbreaking shows. And it's a perfect fit, Paul.
I'm a real zealot kind of guy, aren't I? I turned up. I don't know how that happened. And before that, I was in Toronto for that groundbreaking Dodgeball, which was, by nature, a show which took advantage of the performer's talents anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was doing impressions, older impressions at that time, Groucho, you know, things like that, Laurel and Hardy. They would put them in the show. Any, you know, these kids were so talented, and they could do Marty Short. I mean, he... Some of the stuff, Sinatra. No, but who was doing? What 22-year-old kid was doing Sinatra?
Yeah.
Back in those days. Well,
yeah.
He was in the show.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, certainly a blessed life comedically. I love to laugh more almost more than playing the piano, but not quite.
Yeah.
You know, so I still get to do my two favorite things. Fantastic.
Absolutely. 30 years with Dave, Late Night and Late Show.
Yeah.
Did the friendship grow quickly? You had such a great camaraderie to me watching you as a viewer on air.
The friendship grew quickly, and then the on-air relationship kind of followed, you know. and just developed as the show developed and got looser, Dave felt more and more comfortable, so comfortable that he would, you know, even give it up to me and say, if you have anything, jump right in.
Yeah, I love that.
What other boss would say that?
Yeah, very rare.
You know, and so I started to jump in, and ultimately it became a, you know, then there was a point where he said, you know, you jump in with a kind of with a funny quip, which is great. He said, but what I would love is if we just had a conversation. And you didn't, you know, none of us knew what we were going to say. Neither of us had anything planned. And so eventually we started doing that. And that, of course, is the true fun. That was like improvising in Second City, but being on television doing it and doing it with the quickest, fastest mind still, I think, in show business.
Absolutely.
And so, very, you know, and talk about a blessing.
And very comfortable. You guys had a very comfortable relationship on the air.
He made me comfortable, and I was able to improvise with him. And I noticed that elsewhere, I was on another show, he wasn't quite so comfortable. So he really did, you know, he set me up. I must say, I was a straight man for him, but he enabled me to get my own laughs, too.
Absolutely.
What could be better?
And I was watching I had Don Rickles on last year, and we talked a little about his relationship with Johnny and Ed and you and Dave. And he just said that was just some of the best, most fun that he's ever had on the air. And as soon as Johnny left, you know, it was all Dave and Dave and you, and he would engage you also in conversation, and always, always so much fun.
Well, I think he paid me one of the highest compliments the first time he was ever on Letterman's show. He turned to me and he said, Paul, have yourself committed.
He did. I just watched it yesterday.
I tell you, yes, well, what a, you know, to have Rickles say that about you, what a compliment.
Absolutely.
I was touched. I was touched and moved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you've had to have, and I know you've been asked this before, so forgive me, but I'm sure you've had favorites. You've played with everybody. I mean, you've played with everybody through the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, through the late night shows, through SNL. You have played with the biggest and the best. And I know there's got to be some of the, like, top three in your mind that you revered when they walked on stage and you got to play with them. I think one of them may have been James Brown.
Well, I've said it before, and of course I'll say it again right now. Yes, there was nothing like playing with him the first time in 1982. James Brown was one of the early guys who did the show, actually called us and said, I'd like to come on.
Wow.
He heard me and the band playing his stuff, you know, going into commercial. And he came on, and he also said, what songs would the band like to play with me? He let us pick our favorites, and boy, did we picked a few obscure ones, like Sex Machine. You still see it on YouTube because it was so hot that I never thought I could play like that. But when you start hearing that voice and him dancing a little bit, I mean, you play like you never thought you could. So that's right up there. And otherwise, I don't know, you got kind of feel loyal to the early people that did it. Carole King did it early.
Wow.
And Sly from the Family Stone. You know, that triumvirate right there, I don't think I ever topped that as far as getting to play with people that I idolized as a kid.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So one of America's most respected, recognized, and experienced broadcast journalists, Leslie Stahl, is celebrating her 26th season on the iconic CBS News magazine 60 Minutes. Leslie has won nearly a dozen Emmy Awards. She has covered every president since the end of the Nixon administration, including an exclusive interview with the Trump family last November. The most vivid and transformative experience of Leslie's life was not covering the White House. It was becoming a grandmother. In the New York Times bestselling book, Becoming Grandma, The Joy and Science of the New Grandparenting, which is now available in paperback, Leslie has explored how grandparenting changes a person's life. And to share that journey of grandparenting, Leslie Stahl joins us in studio this morning. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Dave. It's so nice to be here.
So great to have you in studio. And I must tell you, congratulations on 26 years on 60 Minutes.
Oh, you make it sound so long. Oh, my goodness.
You're just a baby.
It's flown by. I miss the guys I started with, like Mike, and more recently, Morley Dyed and Bob Simon. But for me, I love what I do. You know, each story, I'm a grandmother, but each story is a baby.
Yeah, that's right.
I get deeply into it. The great thing about 60 Minutes is that we get to pick our own stories.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
We like everyone that we do. We're committed to it. So it's a
and
good
you're,
thing.
And you're invested in that story, obviously.
Precisely, yeah.
You have had the most amazing career in broadcast journalism. And I know you went to Columbia University, but you were studying zoology, I think.
Exactly.
<right?
laughs> They have this great school of journalism, and there I am dissecting a frog. Yeah. I learned pretty soon at graduate school in zoology that this was not for me because I didn't want to touch anything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I wanted to wear gloves for everything. And the assistant professor came by, I remember, and he said, you know, if you don't want to touch anything, you're not going to be a good doctor.
Good tip.
Okay, I'm out of here.
That's a good tip. Is that kind of where you said, what else am I going to do? And was journalism the calling at that point?
You're not going to believe this. No. I answered an ad in the New York Times. I quit graduate school, and it said researcher. And I majored in history in college, and I love doing research. So I answered the ad. And it turned out to be a job at the mayor's office in New York working on the speechwriting staff. And I loved that job. Had no idea in my head where it was taking me. Just loved the job. And walked into the press room one day, reporters hang out in City Hall, and asked one of the reporters, what do you do all day? And when he finished telling me, I knew.
That was it for you.
That was it.
That was it for you. And I know you also worked for NBC News. You were on to London working for the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Was it at that time you weren't feeling very challenged, like you wanted to do more than what you were doing at that time?
Well, they sent me NBC. I'd worked on the campaign as a researcher, the 1968 presidential campaign as a researcher. And then NBC sent me to London. And I wasn't being challenged at all. I was, when you talk about junior, what's three steps below junior? That was me.
Mm-hmm.
And a really wonderful man, then president of NBC News, Richard Wald, took me aside and he said, you know, you think you're going to start at the top. NBC News, that's the top. If you really, really want to be a serious journalist, you have to go backward, take five steps backward, and start at the very beginning and learn every step of being a journalist. And he said, go work on a newspaper, go work at a wire service. So I started to apply. Nobody really was hiring me. So I went home. I was living in London. I went home and got a job at the local Boston CBS affiliate.
Yeah, yeah.
And started at the bottom and loved every single day.
Oh, it's amazing.
Even at the bottom, I loved it. Loved it.
How wonderful.
Have actually loved every day since, believe it or not.
And then CBS News, just in time for Watergate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know why I got on Watergate? Mm-mm. I was the newest person in the bureau because no one thought it was anything but a local Washington, D.C. break-in. And so they said, okay, well, it was at the Democratic National Headquarters, so we'll send her just to make sure. Why not?
Yeah.
And that's how it. It's,
that was
that
the very
was
beginning. That was the very beginning. And you've covered, you know, Watergate, President Ford, White House correspondent for Presidents Carter, Reagan, and the beginnings of Bush 41. And then last November, you interviewed Donald Trump and his family. You've seen so many changes over the years doing this. And, you know, what are some of the significant changes in how the White House has dealt with the press over the years, specifically since Inauguration Day of this year?
The changes have been, I mean, it's as big as an explosion of major proportion.
Yeah.
Because for generations, and when I got to the White House in 1976, the networks were the major way that presidents communicated with the public. In other words, they needed us.
Yeah.
And we were the center of the rhythm of the government because the president wanted to get his message across, and we were on the air at 6:30 every night, and the whole country watched news, television news at 6:30. I mean, the whole country. And so we were little princes and princesses.
Yeah.
And then along came cable, and there was no deadline at 6:30. There was a 24-hour deadline. So our role got a little diminished. And then along came the internet and social media. And, you know, we are not nearly as important. We're still important, but not nearly. But the real change is that reporters today do not have any time to think, to make calls, to read background material on whatever the subject is. And I don't want to sound like an old fuddy-duddy grandmother, but I do not think this is an improvement, let's say.
Yeah. And it, I mean, and with the Trump administration, it's been a lot tougher for reporters to kind of find their way through this. But there's a lot of people who think, well, this is new. There has not always been fabulous relationships between presidents and the press. You had mentioned
there's
before.
There's never fabulous, fabulous relationships.
No.
I was covering Watergate, as you said, so I go back to the Nixon administration, and I think the situation was even worse.
Yeah.
There was more hostility, if you can believe it, with the vice president running around the country on a campaign.
Yeah.
To hurt the press.
Well, in the Carter administration, you had mentioned, used to call and just yell at you because they didn't like the way you covered a story.
Oh, yeah. Jody Powell would pick up the phone, call me, and just scream at me.
Yeah.
And thank God it was on the phone because I cried.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that abusive. My father didn't yell at me, so I wasn't used to this.
Yeah.
And, so the you're right. The relationship between the White House press corps and the president has never been good. And I understand that it was horrible during the Obama administration.
Yeah, yeah. But Reagan was a whole different story.
Reagan was a different story because it was also professional.
Right.
You know, this is an interesting thing. The Democrats who take over the White House, they have an expectation that the press is going to be on their side. The sort of sense, the image, the assumption that the press is liberal. So the Democrats think we're going to give them, you know, we're going to give them a break. And when we don't, they feel betrayed. And that sense of betrayal turns into hatred for us, toward us. The Republicans don't expect that. At least this was true of the Reagan administration with so many professionals running the White House. And they treated us so fairly. Without emotion, without that sense that we owed them anything or they were expecting anything, it was just straightforward. There was less, believe this, there was less sexism toward me.
Interesting. Okay.
In the Reagan White House than in the Carter White House, with President Carter promoting the Equal Rights Amendment, Ronald Reagan being against the Equal Rights Amendment, and yet the way they dealt with the women reporters was
different level
more
of
fair.
Interesting.
More equitable.
Is there any time, because you were in Washington for so long and host of Face the Nation and so forth, do you miss Washington?
I do.
Okay.
I don't think I'd want to be covering the Trump White House per se, but I miss having a daily piece of the story. Yes.
Ah, interesting.
And being able to interview, as I did on Face the Nation, the newsmaker of the day. Because as you see on 60 Minutes, I did interview President Trump 3 days after he was elected,
and that
was great. But most of our stories are what we call on the bias. So if there's a big story, we're trying to do something that's not the daily story. We're trying to give you a little depth or a little side story that's related. So I miss being in the center of it all the time.
Gotcha. Can you share anything you're working on for 60 Minutes? Anything exciting?
I have three more stories for this season. You know, we go into reruns in late May.
Yeah, we're getting close.
I have interviewed a man who is the last surviving prosecutor of Nuremberg.
Wow. Yeah, that's a wow.
It's a wow.
Yeah.
And he became an expert on war crimes. And he's 95, and so altogether, it's kind of breathtaking. He's younger than I am, really, in every way. With a perfect memory of the trial and the fact that he, before that, had gone into the concentration camps with the military liberators. And remembers all of it. So this is a very emotional and smart interview with a great man. So that's coming along. And I have Tom Dart is the sheriff of Cook County.
Yeah, right.
I have a profile of him.
Awesome.
Coming
Looking
along very
that.
Soon
yeah.
in a couple of weeks. So those two and one more about a federal judge. In the Ninth Circuit, which is the court that will look at the president's travel ban again, he's in the appeals court. So
Yeah, big stories coming up.
Three good ones.
Three big ones coming up. Well, Leslie's new book is now in paperback. It's Becoming Grandma, the Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. And, of course, you can catch Leslie every Sunday evening at 6 Central on 60 Minutes on CBS. Leslie, thrill having you in studio.
Thank you, David. Thank you. To be with you again.
Thank you. A pleasure. Pleasure is all mine. News is next on 720 WGN.
Baseball time is here again. You can catch it all on WGN.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So the world champion Chicago Cubs David Ross retired last fall after hitting a home run in Game 7 that helped the Cubs win the World Series. And with his excellent footwork, he knows how to swing and has proven it every week thus far. And to break it all down for us is Dancing with the Stars MVP David Ross. David, what's up, my friend?
Good morning. How are we doing, Dave?
I am great. I am great. So you decided to trade the ballpark for the ballroom, and you just cha-cha'd your way to the next round. Congratulations, buddy.
Thank you so much. I'm having fun. I did. I traded in my cleats for some dancing shoes, and I'm having fun. You know, when a unique opportunity like this comes available and they ask you, it's such an honor, one, to be asked, and just to do something so far out of my comfort zone and unique. It's just a lot of fun. I'm learning a lot about myself, and it's been a good distraction for me from, you know, missing baseball. I was out in spring training, and, you know, I miss those guys a lot and that competition. So this is giving me – I'm competing with myself and trying to get better at dancing and having some fun with it. So it's been great for me.
So when you were asked to do this, what originally went through your mind? Was it an immediate, yeah, I'm going to give this a shot, or did you have to think about it a little bit?
No chance. Yeah, no. My first thought was like, what? One, you know, when you're they ask you to be maybe the first Major League Baseball player ever to do Dance with the Stars, I'm thinking, why me? You know, because I wasn't a superstar player, and so it makes you think a lot about, you know, what others have done for you, the guys in Chicago, and the things they've said about me to the media, and the way they've lifted me up and put me on this big pedestal that Dancing with the Stars would call. It just made me super appreciative for, one, my teammates and the organization and all those guys that I was a part of last year. So that entered my mind. But my first thought was no. Like, no chance I want to get out there and bear. I mean, I don't know anything about dancing, like, yeah, zero. So it definitely was something like my heart dropped when they asked. And I had more than one conversation with a few people, and Dina, who produces the show, and you know, about just what it all entailed, and she kind of helped me relax and think about how much fun it would be, and she was right.
Now, your partner's Lindsay Arnold. How much practicing went into this up front? I mean, how many weeks did you have until that first episode?
We met March 1st at the GMA, and wow, then went straight to Tallahassee. And so we had about 3 weeks to practice that first day.
Wow.
But you have to take one day off a week. But now it's every day. So after the first show, you practice every day for about 4 or 5 hours a day, and just over and over, repetition. And my body's transforming. I'm losing weight. I don't know if I'm looking like a dancer on the dance floor. My body's slimming out.
Yeah,
been good exercise as well as a good fun learning experience.
Well, looking at like the people you were dancing with and the competition and so forth, what did you say to yourself? At least I'll make it to the first round, the second round. Did you think you'd be here ready today and that coming up to the third episode?
You know, the first thing I thought, I was sitting in at Good Morning America in the little back room while we're waiting to go on, and I see Mr. T and Charo and The Bachelor, and I see all these people on here, and Rashad Jennings, and I'm thinking, you know, this is Dance with the Stars. What am I doing in this room?
That's awesome.
What I was thinking, because, you know, I don't see myself in that light, and so it just was really funny to me to be in that room and around these people who are basically, you know, self-made celebrities, and I was a part of a team and the reason why I was there. So really I was thinking, what am I doing here? What's going on? And then I was super stoked. Mr. T was like one of those guys you just idolized growing up
with
the A-team and Rocky. And so I just picked his ear, and he had his Cubs jersey on that day, and
awesome,
he's from Chicago. So he told me all about him bouncing in Southside and, you know, about growing up in Chicago. I mean, he's just a phenomenal human being. So it's just been fun to get to know all these celebrities on a different level.
And they hit the baseball theme right out of the park. So the first thing you're doing, go Cubs, go. Is that something you said you wanted to do? Or was that like a team of people saying, nah, this is what's going to help you launch the first season premiere here?
Yeah, I think they want the fans of the show to get to know everybody, because everybody comes from different backgrounds and not everybody's a baseball fan that watches Dance with the Stars. So I think they wanted to show where I was, you know, where that came from and what I was all about while I was on the show.
Yeah.
You know, even my partner, Lindsay, I don't know how much she knew about me before we started. So, you know, I understand people from Chicago, their Cubs fans know who I am, but not the whole world knows, you know, who David Ross is.
They do now.
They were showing that. Yeah. Yeah. But, and we don't pick our song or our theme each week. They do that.
Okay.
The producers of the show do that and they send it to us. So we got to adjust. So, it was kind of fun for me just to be comfortable in kind of my uniform and dance the Go Cubs Go because I knew the song.
Very cool. And I know, you know, your home is in Tallahassee. You have a place in Chicago. You're pretty much hanging out in L.A. these days. Are you having a good time?
I'm actually traveling back and forth.
Okay.
I do live in Tallahassee, and I'm on the West Coast this week just because I came. I went down to spring training, and I had a few things to do out here in L.A., I travel back and forth. My son is in the middle, just started his coach pitch league, and I'm helping his coach the team. And my daughter's doing softball and volleyball and has tournaments every weekend. So I'm just kind of going all over the place and making sure I'm still, you know, there for my family and my kids. I don't want to miss those things. That's the reason I retired to begin with. So I want to make sure when I signed up for this that they were able to adjust to my schedule and ABC and dancing's been great with that. Lindsay travels and the producer travels with us everywhere we go. And it's a little bit of a rigorous schedule flying wise for us, but it's worth it for me because I get to take my kids to school still and be a part of their sporting events that they got going on.
That's what I love about you, David. I know your priorities, you know, in life have always been, you know, and I've read about it over the years too, that it's always family first. And then you're back, you know, doing this new role with the Cubs too. You know, you're going to be busy, but you got to love the fact that you're going to have that quality time ahead, not so much traveling with such a young family that you have.
Well, that was the part of taking the job and sitting down with Theo and Jed and them talking to me about what they saw me doing and just easing my way back into some baseball activity. But they definitely wanted to keep me around, which was a huge, huge compliment, and I was very flattered about that. And so just signing back on with the Cubs and being a part of what I feel like is maybe one of the best organizations in all of baseball.
Absolutely.
And learning from a Hall of Fame caliber front office was a no-brainer for me. And they're giving me the freedom to do the things I want to do with my family, which is great.